Hello, welcome to the Game Changer podcast, Sports Psychology and High Performance. My name is Roberto Chiodelli, and this is our very first episode. And I'm very excited to have an extraordinary guest with us today, Dr. Tamara Russell. Tamara is a clinical psychologist, martial artist, and neuroscientist, also a mindfulness trainer. She's involved in international collaborations evaluating how mindfulness training alters brain structure and function. Director of the Mindfulness Center of Excellence in London, she is the creator of the Body in Mind Training Framework, a body-based mindfulness training that allows individuals to turn into bodily reactions and responses, increasing awareness and promoting physical and mental well-being. A mindfulness consultant and trainer in various contexts, Tamara Russell is the author of numerous academic articles exploring emotional intelligence, mindfulness, and mental health. She has also written two books, Mindfulness in Emotion and Hashtag What is Mindfulness. Tamara, thank you very much for being here with me today. Welcome.
Thank you. And what an honor to be the first person to be on your podcast. It's fantastic. So thank you.
So Tamara, could you share with us a bit about your background and journey into the field of mindfulness and movement?
Yes, well, I'm interested in the study of movement, not just physical movements, but also mental movements and those other movements that we often can feel in our body, which is the movements of our emotional life in the body. So my journey started off studying psychology and neuroscience, and I was particularly interested in neuroimaging, which is the study of where the blood flows around the brain, which can give us some insights into how different regions of the brain are involved in different sorts of functions. And at the same time as I was doing my PhD, I became interested in martial arts, and I began studying Shaolin Kung Fu. It wasn't conscious at that point, but when I reflect on my journey, what I recognize is that I was maybe balancing a very heady academic and conceptual approach with a really deep embodied learning that comes through the martial arts. And so as my career progressed, I was weaving those expertise together. And I was particularly interested in terms of the mental health work, working with people that might struggle with mainstream psychological interventions, or who might struggle with traditional sorts of mindfulness practices, which are often seated and require stillness. So that was really how mindfulness in motion and the body and mind training protocol was born, through this mixing and blending of psychology, neuroscience, movement, martial arts, and really with the intention of trying to make mindfulness more accessible, and particularly for the people that say, I can't do it.
Yes. Great. Yes. And it makes a lot of sense to me too, because I took psychology as well, and it is a very intellectual course. We tend to think a lot about the mind, and we don't talk very much about the body and the movement and having this balance and having, and of course, the mind is everything, it's all together. So it makes total sense. Could you tell us why movement? Why this is so important for our brain? So we studied these connections. So, of course, you said martial arts had a lot to do with that. But why is this so crucial?
Well, I might approach this kind of with several answers, if I may. I think you mentioned that many psychological therapies are quite heady, quite intellectual. even though mostly we experience emotions in the body, a lot of the history of how psychology has developed has really been more about the head than the body. And there's actually been a reluctance to move in therapy or to really do body work. Certainly in mainstream therapies, there are lots of movement-based psychotherapies, but certainly here in England, they're sort of seen as a separate kind of therapy. They're gaining in popularity now, but in the years when I was training, you know, you sit in a chair and you talk. And what I noticed was that that's really hard for many of the kinds of people that I was working with who maybe came from a background of trauma and really needed to move the body and work the trauma through the body. Or they had just like monkey minds that would go all over the place. And, you know, we'd get tangled up in concepts and going round and round. And it's kind of like just using the body and the movement to cut through that. And really recognizing that there are multiple sources of knowing and that this cognitive knowledge is only really one source. And we have such a richness of information about our experience that comes not only from the body, but also from the study of how we move, how we approach, how we avoid moments when the body is activated or withdrawn. There's so much information that's coming into our brain that we can use as part of this big data to help us make sense of our experiences. So that's kind of one part of it. I mean, secondly, we have a huge academic base of literature that points to the benefits of movement. You know, moving and going out for a walk or behavioral activation is kind of step one in cognitive behavioral therapy for depression. So there is a recognition that just moving alone does something to help activate the mind, to help restore or reset the body. And regular exercise has been shown to be as effective as antidepressants, for example, like Prozac. Again, we tend not to hear about that so much. And it's probably easier for a doctor to say, take this pill rather than let's go for a walk. So there's maybe some practical things there. But just moving the body alone is something that's really great for us. And more important now, because we spend so much time sitting and with our head in the computer and really with our head kind of activated by all the stimulus of the computer, we forget that we have a body. And, you know, maybe even I just might encourage those who are watching, you know, feel free to just do a couple of shoulder rolls or, you know, move the body, stretch a little bit while you're watching this podcast, because we can really forget that we have a body.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then movement practices tend to be, in a traditional mindfulness sense, a bit of an add-on. You know, most of the work is done in the seated or the still practices, and then there's a bit of movement or a bit of mindful stretching. But if we look to the Chinese traditions, Eastern traditions, more from Chinese practices like Qigong, Tai Chi, you know, martial arts, Kung Fu, these are meditation in motion. They're a little bit more difficult to penetrate because some of the teaching and the language can be quite tricky for people. But for me, those movement practices are a type of meditation. And we can maybe go into the specifics of that in if you want to follow up with that.
Of course, it would be great to talk about it. For me, when I have my mindfulness groups here, especially here in the university, I always use body activation. That's what I say. Let's have some body activation. Let's feel our bodies first, because when you touch, I remember in one of your classes. So for those who don't know, I took the course. I took the body mind framework training with you, which was amazing. So I remember you saying, when I touch my body, it is now. I know that I'm feeling it at this moment. So it's much easier than to focus on our thoughts, which are so subjective and so quick and so crazy. And so for me, like having this body activation first before having a quiet position or a quiet meditation is so important. But please, could you talk a little bit more about it?
Well, and of course, most mindfulness teachers and trainers, you know, their story is in their teaching and their training. And so certainly I have one of those minds, which when I first tried to sit still and bring my attention to the body, it was really, really difficult for me to do that. I mean, I was kind of almost overwhelmed by thoughts and that increased awareness of the body. It was kind of too much sensation for me to be aware of. And I'm pretty sure I was mostly practicing judging and comparing and mind wandering rather than any mindfulness per se. But what the martial arts taught me was that the sitting practice is very different if you move fast, move slow, and then sit. And so for many years, I ran a class on Sundays, which was an hour of Kung Fu, an hour of Tai Chi, and then 45 minutes of seated practice. And so many of my students said, I never would be able to do 45 minutes practice, but I've moved the body, I've got a little bit energetic, I've then trained the brain's braking system, slowing down a little bit with the Tai Chi, and now I'm in a mode where I can sit. Now, perhaps some of that is we're getting rid of some energy, we might be working through some emotions, maybe we're just tiring ourselves out, you know, just taking some energy out of the head to make it easier to do the sitting practice. But that would really be a top recommendation for anybody that's struggling to do mindfulness. I mean, don't worry about mindful movement even, just move, you know, go for a walk, put on your favorite dance tune, dance around a little bit, you know, just kind of let some of that energy come out of the body before you go to a seated practice. But if you want to do mindful movement, there's kind of like a whole nother layer, which then comes into play. So if you're training in martial arts and Tai Chi, absolutely, you need to focus your attention, certainly when you're learning the movements. So there's that phase that you go through when you're learning the movements that really requires you to focus, manage the mind wandering, follow what the teacher's telling you, listen to your body, notice the angles, the positions, the rotations. And in doing so, you're feeding the brain's body systems, the systems of the brain that code for the angle, the tonus. Is it tight? Is it soft? Is it angled? How far is my arm from the body? All that spatial body somatic information that you're training there, you know, enriches the brain's sensing capacity of the body. Once we've learned the movement, then we're into that kind of consolidation phase. And here, actually, the mindfulness training is increased because there's a tendency for the movements to go into automatic. And actually, we want to stay present with them. So, you know, when I'm not at my best, I can do all my Tai Chi forms whilst thinking about emails that I need to send and projects that I'm working on and what I'm going to do later, because they're just in my body and my body knows what to do. Now, I might choose to do that if I'm using movement to kind of help with the creative process or to help me think through something. You know, it's like going for a walk and suddenly you have a great idea. You could use it for that. But at my best, I'm in every movement as if it was for the first time, really tuning into the sensations of the body, noticing, feeling, sensing, trying to stay as present as I can as those sensations unfold over time. And that's why mindful movement is good for busy, busy monkey minds, because there's a constant set of sensations that you have to attach your attention to as the movements unfold. Now, if you want to go deeper, you can. And this is what I love about the movement sciences and what I think is missing when we just only do seated practices. Tai Chi tells us that the origin of every movement is intention. Yi, mind intention. The movement starts in the mind with a decision to make the movement. The body then brings up into working memory the pacing, velocity, tonus, tension, position, angles, all of this kind of incredible information, biomechanical information about how to make the move. And then the signal is sent into the spinal cord and out into the body. So I simplify by saying there's intention, the kind of preparation for execution, where we can do some fine tuning, and then the sensations. So not only can we pay attention to sensations in the present moment as they're unfolding over time, we're also training in that ability to kind of go before the sensations into intentionality. And that awareness of intentions, I think, is key for any consciousness training or transformation of mind. And the people I work with anyways, finding that in the body first is what helps us then make that leap to doing it in the more abstract way, just in the mind.
Wow, yes. I mean, I remember saying there are some levels, and some of them are the Jedi levels, like dealing with the abstract mind. And and I think the body is the maybe the easiest tool to start working with than once you reach the mind. I was thinking, like, nowadays I'm a bit scared of myself when I'm using the internet, because I want to surf in the internet, but I end up drowning on the internet. The stimuli are so strong, and there are so many, they're so appealing. Mm-hmm. And I'm still like, okay, what can I do? I have to, and once I start practicing more, getting a little bit more away from this, I noticed that when I'm more mindful, so I spend more days practicing, it's easier for me to avoid this or to take better decisions, right? So my question is, so how can these practices help people who are in high pressure or under difficulties? So we're talking here about high performance. So how could it help them?
Well, I'll just pick up on your comment about technology.
Yeah.
So one of the practices I really like, my phone is not next to me at the moment, so I'm gonna work with my mouse. But you know, it's almost like do Tai Chi with your technology. So, you know, if I'm scrolling or I'm picking up my phone, I'll use the mouse as an example. You know, can I go like slow motion Tai Chi, feeling the body, feeling the hand, approaching the object, going a bit faster now for you. And then even that click, that is we can make that click a mindful movement. And I have a lot of practices with the hands because it's such a rich object to practice with. It has a big amount of brain dedicated to the hands and the movement of the hands. So, you know, I can even spend a 10-minute practice of just lifting a single finger. I mean, it's just incredible what you can sense. So, you know, think about the hand movements that you're making, you know, whether it's clicking send on an email or post on a Facebook or a social media or opening another tab on your computer. In the motor system, there's an intention and execution and the sensations of it. But what you're describing is that our intention has been hijacked. It's been hijacked by the sensations and the dopamine and the automaticity. I mean, it's designed to capture us, but we lose our intention. So my tip is regain intention in the motor domain. I mean, we've lost it in the other domains, right? Mm-hmm. Emotionally, we're attached to the computer. Cognitively, we're captured by the computer. Motor is where we can get back control. So, you know, maybe your viewers could experiment with that. You know, the next time you're kind of typing and you go to click send, like really slow down the movement. Now, when we slow the movement down, what this allows us to do is it gives us a chance to open up that portal of intentions. What am I doing and why? And is this in line with things that are important to me? So the going slow also allows us to kind of check in with the motivations and the drivers behind the movement. The more emotional level or the more cognitive level, we use the control of the motor intention, but then it opens up like, why am I picking up my phone now? I'm in a podcast with Roberto. Why is my hand reaching to pick up my phone? What is my intention? My intention is to be present. Now, actually, I knew what my mind is like, so I pushed my phone to one side and out of reach. But I remember Ruby Wax once said, you know, I'm meditating on the cushion and I'm picking up my phone and looking at it. Many people are doing that. I really want to say, don't worry if that's you. But can we just be like curious about that? And I say, for me, the way to get curious is to really slow down. You know, I'm reaching for the, why am I reaching for this? What do I need this? Do I want this? Is it choice? Who is choosing?
Mm-hmm. Who is choosing? Exactly.
Who is choosing? Oh, it's such a great question. And just, you know, we need to amplify the non-judging because, you know, everybody has this process, right? Scrolling and watching stuff on YouTube and Netflix, like again. I mean, yeah. It's okay.
Yeah, it's okay.
How do we get curious if we want to try and do things different, or how do we shorten the amount of time?
Yes, exactly. It's so addicting. I'm impressed by it. So I have, and I imagine that, okay, most of the people who have access to this technology have to deal with this, and it's not easy. It's, and the amount of information and data is overwhelming. So, and I think that mindfulness is, there's a reason why mindfulness is growing, because we kind of need this more and more. Yeah.
But there's something there about like really harnessing intention. And that's, I mean, okay, Kung Fu is also about intention, but Tai Chi particularly has a lot of very rich teachings about, you know, mind intention and choosing and how that choice flows out into the body and out into the world. But what I would maybe say to people is, you know, if you know that you're somebody that gets easily distracted, which is, you know, 80% of people, but some people have it really more challenging, it's some simple, you know, put your phone where you can't reach it when you're working. Put your phone on silent if you can. Yeah, I know there's often mums or carers and they say, oh, I can't put my phone on silent because the school might ring or my mum's in the hospital. But, you know, use the settings on your phone. you know, notifications from this, not from that. Ringing is allowed from this number, not, you know, so there's kind of physical things you can do about distancing yourself from the technology. And then there's more practical things using the technology. It's got loads of stuff in it now to try to help us. And in terms of like, you know, screens, it's always funny when you're on a Zoom call and somebody shares the screen and then you see that there's like 300 tabs open. And I did that once and somebody said, "Oh, Tamara, I thought you were a mindfulness person. I'm really surprised to see." So I was a bit like, "Oh," felt a bit ashamed, but I let that go. But I think, you know, that was a particularly busy day where I was working on multiple projects. But if I'm really wanting to focus, if I'm writing, if I'm, you know, with my clients, you know, what needs to be open and shut, just get rid of the temptation, really get rid of the temptation. I guess the third tip that really helps me is I've got a timer here. So I use a timer for tasks to really help me stay focused in short bursts. So there is some evidence to suggest that actually when we're under a shorter time pressure, that can help us focus our attention better. For some, it's kind of like, okay, I've got this time. For others, it's like, I only need to do it for this time. Okay. And then I can be free.
Yes, this is so, enough. I cannot spend more time.
So, you know, here. There's a few sort of practical things that I would recommend. And then my fourth recommendation is, you know, if you notice that you're getting tired and distracted and you can't manage it, it's not worth sitting at the desk anymore. You know, stop that task, go and reset, dance around. You can't see it, but I've got a little mini trampoline off to the side. You know, jump on your trampoline, go for a walk, pat the dog, have a cup of tea, break, change location if you can, and then come back to the task. So I really encourage that, like be kind, be flexible, be creative, and your brain will thank you.
Yes. Like go for your body, like do something, do some movement. And yes, so these are great, great tips, great recommendations. And now moving and talking a little bit about sports, but when you talk about sports, you can make metaphors for our whole life. But athletes in general, they go through, so usually athletes, they lose much more than they win. Like they, and so they deal with defeats more than conquers. And how can mindfulness help them cope with this, failure of dealing with failure?
Yeah, I think for me, there's sort of three key areas where mindfulness, maybe four actually, where mindfulness can be really helpful. I mean, one is increased body awareness and the benefits that brings for the kind of precision of the techniques that they're doing, the ability to learn and unlearn certain movements, and also the ability to train hard without injury. Or to notice injuries earlier. So there's that whole kind of body awareness piece that I think is can be really beneficial. The second piece that you're speaking to is more maybe the emotional side around how do I deal with failure? How can I be resilient? You know, when I've given 150% and it still wasn't good enough and I have to get back on the horse or, you know, I have to get back to training, and that managing of kind of the mental monkeys, I call them. And of course, comparison is part of sports, isn't it? You're comparing yourself all the time, the times, the positions, the ranks, the scores, whatever it is. So you're kind of training yourself to compare yourself to others. So it's actually quite a tricky skill for an athlete, because a lot of the things that they're doing in a way are kind of anti to mindfulness. Yeah. And so then mindfulness is kind of saying, well, you know, I want you to be aware of it, but relate differently to it. And I've met athletes that have got kind of different opinions on this. You know, there are some that just say, no, you just have to stay with that focused attention. You can't let it in. And I believe that probably does work for some. I think that's not a sustainable strategy. And it can kind of lead to burnout or kind of quite significant breakdowns when that strategy stops working. So the other strategy then is more kind of saying, can I be with those feelings? Can I notice those thoughts? But can I relate to them? These are just thoughts. They're not reality. I mean, there's a bit of reality, which is you came second, not first. But that's not I'm a failure. That's not I'm no good. That's not I can't do it. You know, so it's about that reframing and changing the relationship to the internal dialogue. I think the third area, and I had some experience of this working with young footballers at the University of the West Indies, what they actually said was they found it most helpful for dealing with the stresses in their life off the football pitch. And a lot of it was about relationships and girlfriends or partners, family, money worries, worries about studies. And they said that the mindfulness training helped them to not bring that into their practice sessions and into their games. I mean, the other thing that really stood out was something about being able to let go. One of them talked about, you know, a tackle that was, you know, should have been a red card and wasn't. And he said, well, you know, previously I would have got angry and I would have kind of carried that anger with me and I would have been ruminating about, you know, getting that person back. But after the mindfulness training, I was able to just let, you know, I noticed it. I saw it coming. I watched it building. And then I was able to just say, no, I see you, not now. Please go and sit over there off pitch. I need to be here. I need to be here. I need to let that go. So those, you know, were some really kind of great examples. Yeah, from youngsters. I mean, several of them went on to kind of play for the national team. I mean, they had some really great athletes there. But they were, you know, third year university. So they were in their 20s, you know, early 20s. And this was something quite new for them. It was a really great experience. I've done several training camps for footballers over there.
Yeah. And when mindfulness has this, one of the foundational attitudes is self-compassion or compassion. And how do you see athletes, how do they receive this self-care? Because on the other hand, when you're talking about high performance, we are dealing with perfectionism and you have to be always top. And, I mean, it can be a little tricky sometimes for them to distinguish, okay, I have to push myself, but I also have to acknowledge myself that I'm doing my best.
Well, I can't remember the quote, unfortunately, who said it, but I remember when I was kind of more, not researching academically, but just sort of researching into this area for various projects, there was a coach that said, you know, at peak level, the really hardcore training should be 20% and the rest should be play. So 20% is when you're like really, really training hard and pushing. And 80% is if you can, I'm doing it for the pure joy of it. And I'm play, you know, like a child. That's kind of a mindfulness principle too, isn't it? Approaching like a child with kind of joyfulness and playfulness. And, you know, it's when we're playing that we're relaxed and the body is relaxed and we maybe can find like, oh, that just felt different. And if we'd have been really concentrating on it, we wouldn't have discovered it. But you know, that balance of compassion and competitiveness, it is a tricky one. It's a tricky one to hold. But I think, you know, when I'm talking to athletes, it's often about, you know, how long do you want to be in this game? And there was a famous footballer here, Ryan Giggs, in the UK. And he was kind of famous for basically being like 40 years old and he was still playing. And he wasn't practicing mindfulness, but he, well before it became popular, he was doing yoga every day. And it was that self-care of the stretching, self-massage, you know, stretching the body, listening to the body, holding the poses, not for like strength training, but for softening and flexibility. And my hypothesis there is that, you know, this was a different kind of care for the body that allowed his body to work at peak performance for longer. This is very much the kind of Tai Chi philosophy. I mean, in Tai Chi, the ultimate aim in Tai Chi is to be 100 years old and still doing Tai Chi. That's it. You know, it's about longevity. And you see in the parks, you know, this wizened grannies and grandpas in the parks in China, you know, 80, 90, 100 years old. And, you know, they may not be doing the full form, but they're moving. And that's because in this philosophy, once you stop moving, you know, lack of movement is death. And we see that in the research, you know, adults in the West who fall become scared of moving. They move less. They go to their chair. And then there's this knock-on effect of, you know, low mood, depression, anxiety, cognitive decline, because all those systems are connected. Yeah. So that's really my aspiration, is how can I take care of my body to allow me to keep moving for as long as I can? And so within the athlete, within the peak performance, it's what is that balance that will allow me to keep moving no matter what, for as long as I can at the level that I want to. And stretching is so underutilized in elite sports. It's getting better. There's a lot that's done to the athlete. I mean, great, all the massage, all the physio, all the people working on your body. That's great. But I would say you can do a lot by taking your mind into your own body so that you really get to know your body and its limitations. And that will paradoxically allow you to push yourself more with less injuries.
Exactly. I mean, the more aware you are of your body, the more aware you are of your limitations, how far you could go. So maybe, okay, today I'm going to train in 80% of my capacity because I don't feel as good as I was yesterday. So there is this wisdom, right? Yeah.
Okay. And I think it's tricky. I mean, I watched a really great documentary the other day about the Canadian women's synchronized swimming team. And I think sports like synchronized swimming, gymnastics, some of the other sports where you need to be concerned with weight, that's kind of an interesting area as well. I was down at I went to a retreat that was down at the place where the British gymnastics team trains in the west of England. And I mean, they've got signs all over the place about eating disorders and anorexia and body issues. So I think that's probably quite specialist work, but I think getting a healthier relationship to body and food is maybe particularly important for athletes where weight and shape is part of what's demanded of them. And we see a lot of these body image and eating disorders in those athletes. And, you know, they're suffering mentally as well a lot.
We know that high performance sports is not doesn't have much to do with health, right? So yeah. Not easy. Yeah, it's not easy to be in that in those positions.
Yeah, and I think you know the point that those young footballers made was interesting, because when you're really training at an elite level, you sacrifice relationships. You know, you miss being in the real world, the normal world, the everyday world. And you perhaps don't have some of those checks and balances around you, which is your friends and, you know, friends helping you, friends guiding you, time to talk to people. you know, there's that real fixation on, you know, the next event or the Olympics or the Nationals or whatever is in your timetable. So what I say to kind of athletes that I've worked with around that is actually then it makes it even more important that you're present when you're with the people that you care about and your family. And that's that kind of off the pitch benefits that I sometimes refer to, which is it would be helpful if you're spending time with your partner or your kids, that you're able to be fully present with them, notice that you're thinking about the event, dropping that, coming back, notice that you're thinking that you've got to get up at 6 in the morning, drop that, bring it back, really amplifying the presence with your loved ones so that you can get that soothing and that bonding. That's part of well-being, you know, the connection with loved ones that's part of our kind of repertoire of well-being as social monkeys.
we need to have this sense of community, or otherwise it wouldn't make much sense. Huh? Yeah. And speaking of sports, we have this people talk a lot about being the state of flow. And I think that there is a relationship, but it's not the same thing when you talk about mindfulness and the state of flow. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic that many people are discussing. I think I'll just kind of give the highlights of it. My sense is that flow is an absorptive state. And in the meditation practices and traditions, there are types of practices that are absorptive practices, where we want the whole of the focus of the attention and the awareness to be absolutely absorbed by the experience. And, you know, in it for an athlete, this is, you know, I feel like my body is moving, but it doesn't feel like I'm moving my body, or time is slowing down, or there's some kind of time distortions. I'm not aware of making choices. I'm kind of just doing and reacting and responding to things around me. But there's a sense that the I and the agency has been removed from the situation. If we think about mindfulness is about focusing on an object, noticing when the mind wanders, going, hey, that's my mind wandering, and coming back. So there's a lot of agency there. There's intention to focus. There's the intention to monitor. There's the intention to get back. There is awareness of what's going on, but there's management of it. Yeah. So our working memory is involved, monitoring the ongoing flow of sensations, monitoring whether we're where we thought we were or not, you know, deciding that we're going to get back and having a bit of an argument about, oh, it's so boring, I don't want to, why should I do that? So, you know, there's a lot going on in a mindful moment that really distinguishes it from flow. What I've understood from the research, and maybe there's new studies out there that I'm not aware of, is that practicing mindfulness increases the possibility of getting into flow states more easily and more quickly. So I would see them as things that would augment one another rather than being, you know, synonymous or the same. And I suppose the mechanism, we might speculate, but, you know, certainly being able to calm the mind a little bit probably helps to go into absorptive states, you know, not having so much mental sensations and thinking and planning going on, you know, allows you to slip into that slipstream of absorptive states more easily. Probably, I still think that mindfulness of the body is feeding those sensory systems and those motor systems in a way that would benefit you when you were in a flow state. Those, you know, micro adjustments that might just make the ball spin faster or give you just that slight edge with the precision of a shot. And, you know, it's like oh, your little finger did that, you know, rather than that. There's a parallel, I think, there with Formula One. I can't remember. Maybe it was Ayrton Senna, you know, one of these greats of Formula One. You know, he changed the size of a bolt, you know, this huge car with thousands of parts. You know, just one little bolt was changed and that shaved off 2 seconds, and that made the difference between winning and coming second. And I think that's, you know, that's the same in the body. You know, maybe there's just a tiny adjustment of the neck and the head, which changes the pelvis, which allows the hip to be more fluid. Yeah, I'm fascinated by that, yeah. Those things. And I mean, Tai Chi teach, you know, when you go and you've done this practice with me, when we go in the standing stake practice in Tai Chi, that's what it's all about. It's like really learning how those micro adjustments of the pelvis, of the neck, of the shoulders can make the difference between, you know, being able to stay in the posture or, you know, collapsing on the floor, screaming in agony.
Yes, it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. The more sensitive you are to your body and how you are, the more present you are, the more aware you can be about it. What could they change?
And for me, what's interesting about, I get frustrated, let's say this, I get frustrated when people kind of say, oh, mindfulness for sports.
Okay.
Because if you kind of just want mindfulness for stress reduction, I think go for it. You know, there's a lot of programs out there. You know, you could do a mindfulness-based stress reduction, for example. That was the early work of Jon Kabat-Zinn with the US Olympic rowing team. You know, they kind of did a standard protocol that was basically about stress management. And then, you know, the knock-on effect was they were less stressed and they performed better. I think the more evolved view, and certainly the way that I work when I'm kind of using the brain and thinking about what the brain needs to do, I'm really interested in like, what are the demands of the sport? So for example, I've worked with quite a few cricketers.
Yeah.
And, you know, their problem is they need to be out on the pitch, you know, for hours. And they've got moments where they need to be really paying attention. And they've got moments where they're just kind of standing around and like stuff is happening. I mean, cricket is really fascinating from that perspective. I mean, I don't really like to watch it myself, partly because there's so much hanging around and I'm like, what's going on and why nothing's happening. But think about the demands for those brains in terms of, you know, what does the attention network need to be doing? And would it be helpful, for example, to know that with training, we have this little dial that we can turn using our intention to determine the effort of our attention? I mean, in Buddhism, they call it right effort, right? You know, they have this language of right effort, but, you know, effort, vividness, stability. There's all these kind of variables around attention that we can train that Western psychology hasn't really got the same nuance as when we look at, for example, the Buddhist traditions of shamatha, you know, 9-point attention training. I mean, that's like a PhD in your own attention. I mean, probably an athlete wouldn't have time to do all of that, but you know, there's some of that that could be really beneficial to be able to have some techniques, you know, to turn that up and down and reduce fatigue. Another sport that's interesting is things like rifle shooting. So there's been quite a few studies looking at athletes like decathlon, or where they're doing shooting, for example, archery, or you know, proper kind of shooting. And again, that's like, you need for a short period of time real stability in the body and super super, literally super sharp shooter. There's a song called Super Sharp Shooter. You know, that kind of hyper focus, really narrow focus of attention. So it's a different demand, isn't it? It's a different demand. So if you really looked into the attention training part of mindfulness, yes, you got all the mind management and you got the resilience and blah, blah, blah. But I think there's a lot more that could be done that's kind of sport specific to really match the practices with the demands of the sport. Exactly. And of course, general stress management will always benefit. Increased body awareness will always benefit. But how I like to work with that is just try to get a little bit more bespoke.
And do you think there are, do you see misconceptions of mindfulness in the world of sports? Because people tend to say, oh, it's relaxation or things like that. How do you see?
Yeah, it's not just in the sports world. I think it's everywhere. Yeah. I mean, the common myths are, mindfulness is relaxation. And I have to just do a little plug for my book here, because in hashtag What is Mindfulness, it's a rather battered copy. I go through some of the myths, but I'll briefly
I have her book here too.
wonderful. So mindfulness is relaxing. Well, you know, I've already kind of said we're paying attention on purpose, moment by moment. We're monitoring, we're checking in, we're checking in on what we were doing. I mean, there's a huge amount of cognitive processing going on. So A, your brain is very busy if you're really doing mindfulness. With practice, you might kind of find that process easier, and there may be a sense of relief from less mental activity, which could be interpreted as relaxation, but it's not the kind of like, oh, I'm chilling, I'm just sitting here with my eyes closed doing nothing. And, you know, many people, they sit still with their eyes closed and there's a lot happening for them. Right? They look like they're sitting still on a cushion, but the reality is they're not. Their mind is busy. Their body is screaming with them sensations. Like, it may not be relaxing. The second one is, mindfulness is about emptying your mind. I mean, good luck if you can do that. Well done. In my experience, that's a pretty advanced level practice to actually really empty the mind and not just be blocking and denying and suppressing. There's a lot of nuance there. If you can manage stage two, the mind wandering, a bit better, your mind will be less full. I doubt it will ever be empty. But you can certainly, you know, knock off quite a bit of mental activity with practice as it evolves. So I would say, no, mindfulness is not about emptying your mind. There are practices to do that, but mindfulness is not really one of them. Then people say, oh, is it Buddhism? You're just trying to make me into a Buddhist. What's all this kind of Eastern stuff? The reality is that there's a huge wealth of tradition of mindfulness in Buddhism. It's particularly well elaborated in that contemplative practice. But we find it all over the place. We find it in the psychology of Langer. We find it in other religious and faith traditions like the Christian Fathers. We find it in creative practice. There are kind of versions of it in sports practice. But the take I come from is, but what is the brain doing? So I work with a kind of secular mindfulness that's informed by trying to understand what the networks of the brain are needing to do to create this state of presence. Some people think, oh, it's a bit like a cult. I suppose we must reflect on that, because, you know, it is a bit culty. There's kind of a language and there's sort of phraseology, and, you know, there is a bunch of mindfulness people that are all a bit kind of, oh, I'm just walking around.
Gurus, yeah.
That guru. But that, again, that's not really my style. I'm like, real world, real demands. Yeah, making mistakes, you know, being mindless, but being mindful about it. So I guess it depends on where you learn and the kind of teacher that you've got. But in terms of interacting with the sports world, I think sports psychology is its own branch of psychology. It uses, I think CBT is becoming more popular, certainly visualizations and goal setting and SMART goals. You know, there's sort of quite a lot of basic psychological principles and frameworks that are included in sports psychology at the moment. And then it's always a question of, well, does the mindfulness fit? You know, and why? And why would you do it? Because it is a little bit of a shift to a different kind of model. It's got some slightly different parameters to it that might be at odds with maybe traditional sports psychology. And I'm not trained as a sports psychology, but I've had kind of a few interactions, and I think there's a misunderstanding about what the mindfulness is, which can create some barriers sometimes. And then you're left kind of trying to explain it all. And then that gets confusing, because the more you try to explain mindfulness, the more complicated it gets, and you just need to practice it. But you've got someone saying, well, I don't understand, and what's it going to be like? So again, I like to come back with this really targeted formulation, like, okay, so you know when the players are on the field and they get into a ruck with another player and they get too much emotions and da 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 da. Right. You know, when you've got a young player that's like really promising, but you know, they're having relationship difficulties, they've got a girlfriend problems, they've got money problems, they've got problems with their schoolwork. Right. This is how it's going to help. You know, you've got this great rider, amazing horse, like really amazing. They're going to go into the, you know, into the Olympics or into the Pan Olympics or something like this. But she gets extremely nervous as she's riding into the ring. Right. This is exactly what we would do. How mindfulness would help this.
Yeah.
Actually, I have an example of that. She's not Olympic level, but she competes at kind of amateur level dressage. And we did a piece of work about mindfulness of the body in the saddle, acknowledging the anxieties. Like when she mounts up and she's in the ring and there's other horses and other riders kind of coming in and out. And she said, I notice, like, I'm fine when I'm getting ready. I'm fine when I'm warming up. It's just this bit where I'm suddenly exposed to all the other riders and I can hear the ring and I can hear the judging. And I suddenly just like freeze. And then my horse freezes and then I freeze. And then, you know, and this whole interaction with the animal as well. So we did a kind of like a sort of like a body scan on the horse. Of course, we know the Fofbok, feet on floor, bum on chair, but this was like feet in stirrups, bum on saddle.
Great.
You know, combined with some breathing and just that really acknowledgement, like, these are mental monkeys. Here's my comparison. Here's my judging. Here's my not good enough. Welcome, welcome, monkeys. You can sit on the back of the horse, but you're not allowed in my brain. Yeah. And then she was able to really calm and soothe. And what she also said was, because the horses are so sensitive, it was like this kind of biofeedback that was happening between her and the horse. Oh, it was amazing. I've worked with a couple of riders, one dressage, one show jumper. And it's really incredible because there's another being, and horses are so sensitive to emotions.
Oh, it must be amazing. Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool.
Wow. You've worked with a different number of sports. So you worked with football, horse riding.
Yeah. Cricket.
Shooting. What's that? What is that called?
The shooting. That wasn't me. That was some early research. But yeah, cricket and horse riding and cricket, horse riding, football. I'm sure I've worked with others, but my mind's gone back. I mean, I work a lot with martial artists as well, of course. Yeah.
Oh, Tamara, thank you very much for everything. I'm sure you could spend much more time here. If there's anything you'd like to add, so I'd just like to thank you. And also, you could share your contact if people are willing to get in touch with you to, you know, get some training.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I will do a quick, I already plugged this one. What is mindfulness? But your readers may, your viewers might also be interested in mindfulness in motion. These are both on Amazon. And I've got a kind of new project that I've been working on over this last year, which is a kind of a course on how to use the neurocognitive model of mindfulness to really train and sharpen your attention and get to know your wandering mind. So if there are people out there that would be interested in that, then please do get in touch. We've got kind of like a waiting list at the moment for people to join that course, but it's kind of with an app and also with some individual coaching and like really breaking it down so that you can really delineate those four stages and different practices designed to do different kinds of mental gymnastics and really train your familiarity with your brain and its network. So that has been my work for the last year, and it's 99% there. And I might have to work with my perfectionist monkey a little bit and tell it to stand down and just get it finished. But yeah, thank you so much for this opportunity. It's been great.
So is there a website or something we could, or I don't know, social media where we
You can find me on Instagram, Dr. Tamara Russell. That's probably the best place. Dr. Tamara Russell. And I also have my website, which is www.drtamararussell.com. And I'm putting quite a lot on my YouTube channel, trying. I guess this is what you're trying to do as well. Yeah. Little bite-sized practices and kind of things to just help people understand mindfulness. So on YouTube, it's, I think it's Tamara Russell, The Mindful Misfit.
Okay, that's awesome. Tamara, and one last thing is, could you, which, is there any practice? I know mindfulness offers different meditations, different practices. So maybe could we finish our talk with a little quick practice? I think, like you said, mindfulness has to do with practice much more than with theory. And so we have to go through it and tell ourselves how we experience it. So is there an exercise you like doing? So a quick exercise you could finish today's
interview. Let's just do, I mean, my favorite one, of course, is a movement. And for those that are, you know, watching on a screen, you know, look, both of us, right? We just shifted our positions, didn't we? That's so obviously we were in a kind of some sort of accommodating position. So, you know, first of all, that's already a practice as far as I'm concerned, bringing the body into an alert but relaxed posture. It's called sung in Tai Chi. It's the body version of mindfulness, right? There's an alertness where there's some effort in the spine, gently pulling the tummy in if you can, but we keep everything else soft and relaxed, shoulders, hands, arms, face. Just taking three breaths, three normal breaths. Turning the camera inwards and directing the focus of your attention to the shoulders. You might wish to slightly drop the chin or investigate. Where's that just right position for the chin? And we'll start to gently roll the shoulders backwards. You might notice that you're going at a particular pace. So see if you can drop 20% of that speed, just going a little bit slower. And setting the intention to pay attention to this shoulder roll movement. The stretching of the skin, maybe some aches, pains, tightness. Beginning to explore the different segments of this movement. Forwards, up, back, and down. Each part of that movement has different sensations and effort. Position. One more. Super slow motion. And come to rest. Transition from moving to stillness. And finishing with some gratitude for the body. Thanking the body in a way that feels comfortable for you. Thank you, shoulders. And finish with three breaths. And it may be that the body is asking for some massage or other movements. So often after a mindful movement, another movement is suggested, right? Because you think, oh God, yeah, that side is a little bit tight. You know, I need to just, that side feels different from this side, or gives, you know, we get this information, right?
Yes. Thank you very much. It's like the domino effect. So once you start paying attention to something, other things come up. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, Tamara. It was great. I hope everybody, I'm sure everybody enjoyed. And we'll meet you in the future. We can, and I'm sure there's a lot to talk about. So in the future, we can have some other meetings and interviews.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Obrigado. Like this.
Yes.
Obrigado.